All right. Hey, guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 158. In this episode, our fake guest is Mr. George McKay of the film 1917, which we're going to talk about just in a moment. Before we do that, though, I want to let you know that I'm your host, Vince, and over there is Phil.
Hey.
There's Phil. Also, I want to remind you that Three Drinks In is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen. Make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review, hopefully a positive one. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @ThreeDrinksInPod. You can like us on Facebook, and you can email us if you want to at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, you ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, episode number 158 with our fake guest, George McKay.
Fake guest.
He's not really coming. We took that one-star review very seriously, very personally, too.
Yeah, sorry, everybody.
Ginger ale, it's a bit.
Yeah.
I couldn't find that meme to put on, like, Twitter or on Instagram of Barney with Britney Spears. It's a bit, guys.
It's a bit. Yeah, that was a bit. We were doing a bit. Like, don't worry about this. It's rock candy. Like, it's not a real engagement ring.
She was great in that. I was so surprised that Britney Spears had enough comedic talent in her to play that kind of crazy character.
Yeah, well, it didn't require a ton of acting, so.
No, it didn't require a lot of acting, but like she had to create this weird character and then like kind of stick with it, and she had to be consistent in it, and she was strange.
Yeah, she definitely was strange.
You know, it came so out of nowhere, like, it's her. I thought she was dead. Oh, wow. And then she's doing like a residency at some Vegas showroom like Celine Dion.
Yeah. No, that's the Vegas residency is a big business nowadays.
It's been big business for years, but
it
kind of dropped off. Like, you know, there's like this weird in between time. So you had like the Rat Pack in the '50s, and I guess a bit in the '60s, and then, you know, like nobody really went to Las Vegas until everyone decided, hey, if we get them to come here with things besides gambling, they'll spend more money, and they went, oh.
Yeah, well, now they got a lot of big name people again, you know.
Yeah, both entertainment and like the restaurant scene in Las Vegas is out of control. Mm. Like if you're a name, you have to have a spot in Las Vegas where you just print money. That's all you do is just print money. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Total side note, but anyway. All right, so we're pretending to wait for George McKay to show up and talk about his role in 1917. He's not here yet. Surprise, surprise.
It feels like, whose line is it anyway?
Right.
Topics are made up, and the guests don't matter.
And the points don't matter, right?
Yep.
Or Norm Macdonald. And now the fake news.
And now the fake news.
Which I think was the best part about his stint on that was like, you know, like there wasn't any pretense. It's like, we're going to do the jokes as if we were on the news, but we're not. Moving on.
I always thought he was great at that.
He's my favorite. I mean, so Jonah Goldberg likes to say that like the golden age of sci-fi is 16. Meaning that, like, whatever you were into at 16 is like the best sci-fi for you. I think the same is true for SNL.
I think the same is true for almost anything.
Yeah, but I guess that's technically true, and like for music and things like that. But you can still come across. I mean, you're so impressionable for things like music at that age.
Yeah, I think from like 13 to 16 is when you are just like, you are the moldable Play-Doh that every emotion is going to hit you so hard. So definitely for SNL, where like everybody has their generation of that show.
Yeah.
You know, like when I think about it, I think of Will Ferrell, and I think Norm Macdonald was before that. I saw him a little bit, but it was definitely like Will Ferrell and Daryl Hammond and all those other guys.
Sherry O'Terry.
Anna Gasteyer.
Yeah, yeah.
But like there's a whole generation of people that grew up with, you know, the guy from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
And like Keenan Wayans.
Yeah.
You know, who's been on the show forever now. Like he's like one of the oldest people on that show. So, like he's yeah. playing the dads now. And
he used
all
to be
those...
on All That.
Yeah. Keenan and Kel.
Yeah. So. But Norm Macdonald, I thought, was always pretty good.
Oh, yeah. So, anyway, but 1917. So, for those not aware, this is a new war film from about WW1, directed by Sam Mendes. Is it Mendes? I keep seeing Mendes.
I thought it was just Mendes.
Right? Yeah, that's what I've said for years, but apparently not.
It's Mendes?
Yeah, everyone I've heard say it says Mendes now.
I'm not going to call him that. Sorry, Sam.
Just call him Sam.
But this is his movie.
Yeah, his movie. It's one of those faux single take a la Birdman. And I'm trying to think of another movie that does this for the whole thing. I know there was a Hitchcock film back in like the 30s or 40s or a long time ago. And I remember watching a YouTube video from, I think, Now You See It, which is one of these sort of cinema critique type channels, talking about the long shot or the long take, and being rather critical of it. And he mentioned that this was done by Hitchcock years and years and years ago, and it seemed ancient because just the film looked so poor, and like this was kind of, you know, like an early Hitchcock work, not like The Birds, which looks like it could have been done, you know, pretty recently. Mm-hmm. But so it's, you know, not a new idea. It's been kicking around. What did you think of 1917?
I thought it was okay. I thought it was a very effective film. And even though I didn't know much about these two men on their mission, and I didn't know much about the war or the situation they were in, I still felt a little bit of emotion as they went throughout the whole film. Yep. What did you think?
I loved this movie.
Oh, really?
I did. I thought it was really, really well done. Everything about it, from the stylistic choices, the one-take choice, the performances, I think, are not getting enough credit in all... So this got nominated for Best Picture along with a bunch of other movies that people like actually went to go see, which is a like refreshing change of pace for the Academy to, you know, to cull through the the box office and go, oh, look what all they saw. Let's go see those things too. Maybe we'll like them as well, and not look for, like, you know, The Shape of Water, for Christ's sakes. Mm. But I felt that the actors got snubbed a bit in that regard because their performances were great. I was really, really impressed with them. The cinematography is breathtaking. The pace of the film is good. You know, there's nothing wasted in the movie. It's a pretty tight script. You know, there's a lot being shown and not told. There's, you know, it's not a perfect movie, I guess you could say, but, you know, it's just really, really great. It's one of the better movies I've seen in a long, long time. So, mm-hmm. And I loved it. I thought it was great. So,
cool. All right, podcast out.
Good night, everybody. Thanks very much.
Well, let's talk about the long take first.
Okay.
That's the one thing everybody wants to talk about, and that's the one people seem to have most an opinion about. Like, you know, what would you think? Was it a gimmick, or was it stylistic, or was it whatever? I think it's fine as a style if you have something interesting to look at. You know, so like Birdman did this, and I didn't think it worked well with Birdman because I didn't see how it enhanced the movie at all. Like, the whole time I watched Birdman, I was like, what is the point of doing it this way? You know, it's this claustrophobic feeling that you're right in everybody's faces and you're stuck in their theater with them and what have you. But it didn't have to be that way. It got distracting. This film, you get that claustrophobic feeling, but that's on purpose because, you know, every breath they take could be their last. They're in no man's land. They're through barbed wire and trenches and stuff. And they're a smaller part of a very large conflict that you see specifically at the end when he runs across to stop everyone from charging up into the battle. And the camera is focused on him and everyone is running by him. You know, you get this really sense that something is happening around them that you can't see, you know, and that's a purposeful thing. So, you know, it's obviously not one long take. There are quick edits and tricks that they do, but I thought it was a good idea to tell it like this because it's only about these two guys.
Two questions. One, were you looking for the seams and did you think you found them? Besides like the middle long blackout.
No, I wasn't looking because I knew what it was going in. But when you see things that are slightly off or slightly unusual, they're more. I do notice them. When something walks in front of the camera, like they walk past a signpost or a soldier will blur the camera a little fast. You're like, oh, that's probably a cut right there.
Yeah, I tended to guess that it was wherever there was a frame or two without a person in it. So there was one when they first enter No Man's Land and they find the German bunker. Mm-hmm. And for a second the camera pans from left to right and there are several frames where they're not in the frame. That to me would be a natural place to cut. And then what was the other one? I just had it in my head just now. It ran out of my head. But there was a moment where, when he meets up with the guys in the trucks after his buddy dies.
Yeah.
And they take him so far and find out that they can't go any further because the bridges are out. And then he talks to Mark Strong for 2 seconds and then goes on his way to go to Acoust on foot. There's a moment like when the camera moves to the bridge to look at it and when he's not in the shot, and that I'm just guessing because that was a complicated thing where they had to jump from one end of the bridge to the other before getting shot at. There was this, I didn't read the full article, but there was an article in Vulture that described the challenges of doing this kind of thing because the camera moves so much and there's so many people and it's the scope is breathtaking. But apparently there's like one thing where the camera goes from like handheld to a dolly to a thing to a crane, and like the camera operators are dressed up in costumes, and as they let go of the camera they become extras in the film. Which is the coolest thing I've ever heard of in my life. Like, wow, what a great way to get rid of guys that you didn't, you know, that you can't actually hide. Very, very clever.
Yeah, just dress them up.
Yeah. But I agree. I think that the long take works better here than it did in Birdman. It didn't seem necessary in Birdman. I don't know. I mean, to me, what's always impressive about the long take is the fact that you really can't reset and do it again. You have to know all your lines. You have to know all the blocking. You have to know the cameraman's movements. It's such a particular acting challenge. You know, you can't, you know, scratch your nose. You can't do anything. You're on the whole time. And like having done plays, that doesn't seem that hard. but you know, when in doing the little bit of like camera work that I've done, like you really, you can't do anything extraneous. The camera sees everything, every tiny detail, and it's really up close. So you know, the margin for error is so small that maybe in Birdman that was the point, because it was about acting and about career and about, you know, and so like the with the emphasis on that, I guess it was kind of meta in a way, like, you know, there were, but it wasn't necessary. It was gimmicky in Birdman because there wasn't much of a story there. Here, there's a clear story.
Yeah, there's, the thing is that there's no room to let the characters take a moment so you can see how they react to things. So like in Birdman, when he was having setbacks, the camera just was always moving and it would go on to the next person, or it would just linger on him and then he would immediately start to do something else, because a camera that, you know, is just free floating and staring at somebody, you're just sort of like staring at him like, well, what are we doing here? Whereas like if you're cutting, then you know, your brain is doing this subconsciously, that I'm supposed to be looking at this for a reason. You know, like someone drops dead and you cut to reaction shots. I want to see how they feel in that moment. Okay. In this movie, there isn't any time for that stuff. And that's the point of the movie. They're on a clock. And no matter what happens to us, we just got to keep going. And it's through some of the worst stuff imaginable. And that's what you're supposed to be experiencing as they experience it. So that's why it kind of makes sense to do it that way.
Yeah.
Okay. I can see that.
I mean, Hitchcock said of his choice to do that in the movie that I, whose title I can't think of right now, he said like he regretted doing it because you basically, you remove one of the key tools you have as a director, which is to pull focus.
Mm-hmm. You know, the film was called Rope.
Thank you. God, I was going to drive me crazy. So yeah, like it, once you take away the, you know, the ability of the director to pull focus to where he or she needs to do it, you're really kind of tying your hands, and that can be fun. You know, it's good to, you know, stretch yourself a bit and put restrictions on things you can do. That forces you to be more creative in some ways, but sometimes it just makes things harder for no reason. The fact that this movie's purpose and tone was to be relentless, you know, in their mission, and then ultimately in his mission was, you know, it's one served the other, which was nice. So,
yeah, I think back then they had a lot of limits on what they could do. I mean, his long takes were as long as there was camera in the film. So they were meticulously shot up.
Filming the camera.
So like, you know,
yeah.
When they ran out, that's when the take would end. And they would just, you know, put more film in.
And they couldn't move it too. It was very static. It was like filming a play.
Yeah, you had to be really careful. And in this one, you know, now with the modern movie making, you can move the camera all over the place. And there's more freedom than there used to be with these long takes.
The one of the complaints, or I don't know if it's a complaint, but like one of the things that people said was that it kind of felt like a video game at times. Did you get that feeling in it? Both with regard to the camera, and also to the use of, you know, very famous British actors mixed amongst lesser known guys and extras.
I mean, people say that all the time and they don't know what they're talking about, but I mean, ideally that's supposed to mean that it doesn't feel real. There aren't any stakes. It looks fake. You know, these are all things that video games have. There is some of that in that, I mean, we're just going to spoil it. One of them dies halfway through, you know,
one of the two main guys,
one of the two main characters that the camera's focused on doesn't make it. He gets killed halfway through the film. And the other guy has to keep going. Well, at that point, I know there's nothing going to happen to this guy. He's the only one left.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to pull a real bait and switch, in which case I would be unhappy. So, yeah, I guess there's a little bit of that, you know, because the camera is on them. The chances of something happening to both of them are slim to none, you know, but I found the other ones distracting just because they were so famous.
Yeah.
Like if they had just picked older men, I think the contrast, the fact that these two soldiers were young and the superiors were old, was enough. You know, like they were young, sort of experienced. One was more experienced than the other. Okay, interesting enough. But like Colin Firth, he looked like he was 100 compared to them. And then you're like, hey, it's Colin Firth. Yeah. He's super famous, you know.
They did the exact same thing in Saving Private Ryan. Do you remember that? Like every time they get to a place where they needed to get information, there was a scene with a person. The person in it was always a very big, famous, and sometimes so famous in a different context as to be like Ted Danson has a scene.
Yes, that's right. Ted Danson was in that.
You know, and I forget.
That's distracting.
I forget who plays the general who reads the famous letter from Lincoln, but he was Jason Robards, I want to say.
Yeah, that could be right.
No, somebody will look that up. But I mean, Bryan Cranston, who I don't think was famous at the time, but he had a, you know, a big exposition role in that. And Paul Giamatti, I think, was in one scene. So sprinkled throughout that movie, with that, you know, that included Tom Hanks and Tom Sizemore and a bunch of fairly big, you know, names at the time, even the young guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ed Burns, everybody. You know, I like that. It's fun as an audience member to go, oh, look, there's a guy I know. You know, and that's kind of interesting. And like, they're just there for a bit to give information. And like, that was part of the video game thing too for some people, was that like, you know, once you'd reach level 2, you get to talk to Mark Strong, and then level 3 was the other guy, and then, you know, ultimately your big guy is Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
At the end there. And so for some people, that kind of added the sort of like artificial quality of it, like, you know, because it kind of takes you out of the process.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it did. It was distracting.
Like, I did begin to wonder. Like, they keep talking about the colonel, the guy that they have to follow, or rather track down. And I'm thinking, I wonder who that's going to be, because he'll be rather famous. And well,
I knew it was him just from trailer, just from trailers.
Really?
Like, yeah. The same with that scene with the sniper who shoots him. I saw the trailer.
Oh,
that was in there.
Wow. Okay. I jumped 3 feet in the air when that happened.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, this is the part where the guy shoots him. I was like, which is fine. It was still really tense.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of that stuff got ruined for the trailers.
Yeah. And the guy too in the bunker with Benedict Cumberbatch, the guy with the hat on.
Yeah.
He was, I want to say he was in Harry Potter. He played like one of the rat guys.
Probably.
Yeah.
My wife and I were watching something, some British movie or whatever, or show, and like, oh, so and so is in, it's from Harry Potter. And when we both took a breath, like, that's because there's 10 English actors in the entire country and they're all in the same thing. Like, they just rotate them.
And then the guy at the end, like the very, very end too, was from Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't think of who we played, but yeah.
Yeah. A lot of famous people.
Yep. So, what was I going to say? I lost my notes here. Okay, so what was it that you didn't like quite as much about
this? So my main issue is a lot of the characterization of that, the two guys, and then all the other soldiers that they meet that are not the famous British people.
Okay.
You get the basics of these two. One was in the Battle of the Somme. He doesn't really care much for medals. He's a tough guy. He's mentally tough. You know, he doesn't really want to be there. He's doing what he can to survive. And then you have the younger guy who's inexperienced, worries about being brave and courageous, you know, worried about his brother that he has to go rescue. And then that's about it for the entire film. You don't get much more than that. You know, it's... I got to do this. I got to do that. Oh, what a mess that we're in. Oh, look at that. I was like, okay, you know, that's, there's the experienced guy and the non-experienced guy. And then every other soldier that they meet that's like a grunt are busy talking about the war. Like the themes of the film, they're just spouting out. Like, what are we doing here? Fighting over nothing. Look, there's no man's land. And, you know, they're as bad as we are, or they're worse, but what are we fighting for? I'm like, grunts didn't talk this way. Now, I wasn't there, but I have to imagine they talked about other things besides what was going on at that exact moment. Mm. You see them reading. You see them writing letters home. You see them, you know, I wish I saw a girl once in a while, things like that. But it was all they talked about. So I was like, man, they're really hitting me over the head with these guys.
There's a very clear anti-war message with this movie. And, like, I'm reminded of Kurt Vonnegut talking about Joseph Heller's Catch-22. That when that came out, I believe that was about World War II, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then what was Hemingway's book? Was it Not For Whom the Bell Tolls, or the one that was about his experiences in World War I as an ambulance driver? I can't think of the name of it.
Oh, that was the, oh, yeah, damn it.
You look it up, I'll talk.
For Whom the Bell Tolls? Or yeah, The Sun Also Rises?
One of them, whatever. It was a heavy
Farewell to Arms. Yeah, there's a lot of them.
I think Farewell to Arms was the one. Anyway, so basically you have, you know, Vonnegut was talking about books that were written about war, you know, from 1920 to, you know, 1950 or 60 were about, you know, the glory of it and the sacrifices and the heroism and all that kind of stuff. And then Heller comes along and writes a very, very different portrait of the whole affair. That's, you know, 1,000 times more cynical, and in some ways more realistic about how people actually behave in sort of a complex organizational structure like the army is. And how, you know, like my favorite part of Catch-22 was Milo Minderbinder, the guy. He's like the quartermaster guy who ends up making deals with every single human being under the sun between London and Naples, and ends up being like the mayor of a town in Italy because he's just, you know, he just works the system so thoroughly. And Vonnegut said, like, these are the kind of war books we're going to get now, or stuff like this, not stuff like Hemingway. And it makes me think about that because, like, you know, people in Hollywood are pretty anti-war in general. And so you'll get a couple of pictures like, you know, Midway, or, you know, that came out pretty recently. That's, you know, kind of the greatest hits of all the battles in the Pacific theater in World War II. But like, they're done making Saving Private Ryan's, where they're, you know, there's no questioning of the mission. They're going to make movies now like this. And World War I is sort of, you know, easy territory for that because people are agreed for the most part that it was a waste of everything. War, men, livestock. It was just, you know, a totally needless thing, which is supported by a lot of the evidence, specifically that, like, so nothing, you know, so like that was very intentional if that was what was done, that whole hitting you over the head with this sort of message about it. And, you know, the clumsiness of some of the dialogue with the gruntier the characters.
It was such a contrast between all the grunts and all the older guys, because somebody was saying that, like, the older guys are not on screen. They're basically cameos, you know, Mark Strong and Colin Firth, but they're so much more interesting because of the way they're acting. They're cynical, they're guarded, they're, you know, determined but wary. I mean, they're they're not grunts. And this is why most movies aren't about guys like this. Hmm. And if they are, they're either like, you know, scared out of their mind kind of guys, or like they're out to prove themselves. They're one note Johnny kind of guys, because a commander or something has more responsibility on his shoulders. You know, there's a personal cost. Oh, can I send 100 men out to die or what have you? So, or even the guest that's not really coming. What was his name again? The actor?
Oh, hang on. I minimized the window and now I've forgotten his name. George McKay.
Right. He's a far more laid back, cynical. He's making jokes about, like, you know, should you not happen to get shot in the head, or if you start to get shot, please throw my flare gun back to me because I don't want to lose it. You know, like.
Oh no, that guy who we talked about fake inviting, but we fake invited the other guy. Yeah, the guy in the beginning.
Right.
Yeah, Lieutenant Moriarty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He those characters are slightly more interesting because they feel more human. I always think of not the show, but the movie MASH. You know, those guys in a war situation are always really interesting because not everyone who gets through a war is this stoic character like our main guy. Sometimes they have to crack jokes. Sometimes they have to be, you know, absurdly dark, and they have different ways of coping. It just tends to make it more interesting to watch. So this movie didn't have that, or it only had it for a brief moment and then they were gone. You know, so I was like, I guess the mission is important, you know, saving the brother and saving all these men. But when he died, like when the guy died halfway through, I was like, all right, that's sad.
Oh, come on.
I mean, what's what I mean? Like, the movie was very effective in that the shots and the music and the acting were good enough, but it was just lacking a little bit. That's all.
I don't know. I agree with that for the most part. That there's no time to breathe. There's no time to. There was no humor in the film. Really, there was a couple scenes, like in the back of the truck, where that gets stuck in the mud, and
that was one of the better scenes.
Yeah. You know, the thing gets stuck in the mud, and the guys aren't that eager to keep moving. They're like, well, we could use a break from this, and, you know. And he's like, no, I have to get going. I have to get to Akust. It's really important. And so he's, like, trying to push the truck by himself. And then he's like screaming, and then there's someone like, all right, we'll help him. And then they push it, and then they, you know.
Right, and that's supposed to be him processing his grief.
And also, like, he's juxtaposed in the scene by a bunch of guys that don't care to keep going that fast, where he's really in a rush. Mm-hmm. So, there wasn't a lot, but I did feel that the guy's death scene, the first guy who dies, was extremely effective, just both in how it was shot and the actor's performance and the writing of it too. You know, they're trying to save a German guy, and then you turn around and you look back, and next thing you know, he's been stabbed. But there's this wonderful moment where he's been stabbed. He yells at him. They shoot the guy, and he pulls open his shirt to see what's happened. And he just says, he screams, oh, no. Like, I can't believe this has happened to me. It was funny. It was this, and it's bizarre, too, because the audience sort of feels the same way. Like, here you think you're going to follow, you know, these two guys, you know, best friends across the French countryside or into Belgium or whatever. And you're like, oh, my God, is that guy just stabbed in the gut? Because, you know, if you have any sense, like, that, you don't get up from that. You know, you get stabbed in, you know, anywhere from like the middle of your torso down to your waist, that's it. It's over. You're like, there's nothing you can do about that. And then there's this fairly long scene where they're trying to figure out, and he's giving him information, and then he kind of forgets what happened to him. He says,
I shot?
You know, what happened to me? And he's just like, you got stabbed. He goes, am I dying? He goes, yeah. I mean, I welled up in that. I got teary eyed in that. That was very, you know, that was very well done. Yeah, I mean, so like you're right. There wasn't a lot of characterization to it. There was no depth to these guys. There was a little bit as they were moving through. They served as a foil to each other, in a way that like they learned about each other, and they, you know, you got a sense as to who the other one was. But when that guy dies, that is lost. You know, I think you gain more than you lose with it. I think you gain a sense of urgency. It raises the stakes because he was actually the more talented of the two in being able to get where he was going.
Right. I mean, they got boiled down to what they were good at. You know, he was the guy who's good with the maps.
Yeah.
And I mean, on top of being friends, that's what the other guy was like. I don't know what I'm going to do now because I don't know how to get there. Not as well. Like, and I'm on a time limit. Whereas the other guy was like, I haven't really been in many fights. You were at the Battle of the Somme, which was one of the bloodiest fights in history.
Yeah.
And he walked away with a medal and he was like, I don't even care.
Yeah. You know? And I think also too, like, yeah, you knew that you weren't going to lose this guy, you know, at least to the end, but like you didn't know, like if one of your two main characters dies in like really the first third of the film, you know, yeah, you know, this guy's going to take you to the end of the movie, but like how much farther beyond that will he go? And then you get to that wonderful scene where he's trying to get down the line to get to the colonel and he jumps up above it. Mm-hmm. And it's that wonderful, wonderful shot of him running. It was in the trailer too, but I wasn't fazed by having seen it before because it was just so great and people are getting blown up.
That's why the movie's effective. You got the music, you got people, you know, the imagery is universal imagery.
Yeah.
And he was smart to do a lot of it that way, and that a lot of the gore and the violence until at least at the end when he's walking through the, you know, little war hospital is on the periphery. It's on the edges.
You know, the beginning, you know, too, when they're crawling through. You know,
but even that,
puts
like
his hand in the guy's chest. That was so.
Yeah, but like the dead bodies and everything is on the edges. They don't put a guy with no face in the center of the shot.
Yeah.
It's always them in the center of the shot.
Yeah,
you know. So between that and the music and everything and the silence, you know, you're just made to feel a certain way.
Yeah.
So,
what are your thoughts on Sam Mendes or whatever his name is, Mendes?
Well, he did Skyfall, didn't he?
Yes, Sam Mendes did Skyfall. He did Spectre.
He did Spectre too.
He did Spectre. He's done a lot of movies.
American Beauty.
What else did he do? Road to Perdition, which is one of my favorites. Jarhead, Revolutionary Road. So, now you don't like a lot of these movies, or at least some of them.
The only one I really liked was Road to Perdition.
Yeah.
And that's only because of Tom Hanks. I didn't like Skyfall. I hated American Beauty. Spectre was nothing. You know, they're usually overdone. Like, they're just in love with themselves. It insists upon itself. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, here's a shot. Isn't it different and amazing? And it's like, ugh, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Nice to see you, Sam. Okay, you know.
Yeah, somebody had said that. I think it might have been Jonathan Last talking about, you know, Sam Mendes being too self-serious about, like, here's a shot from an Oscar movie. Like, it is.
Like a film school guy who's trying to impress you.
Yeah.
You asked. Why are you getting mad?
No, I know. And I guess that's true. I can't say that that's not true because there is a sense of self-awareness about a lot of these movies. But I don't know, it doesn't necessarily make them bad. Like, I like American Beauty. I haven't seen it really in a long time. I mean, maybe I should watch it again to see if I still like it. People I know that don't like it tend not to like it because of the sort of clunky political message that it has in it. You know, it was written by a guy named Alan Ball, who was also famous for writing 6 Feet Under. And, you know, basically his whole point was that, like, you know, everybody who is not lying to themselves in that movie is gay, you know, or if, you know, or you know, or unless you're like, you know, the Chris Cooper character, like you're lying to yourself, you know, more than anybody, and you're gay. Like, there's some sort of freeing thing about the, you know, the homosexuals in that movie, and sort of looking at the American suburban lifestyle as sort of a, you know, a construct that is really only, you know, is shallow and rotten at its core. And I never got that because I was 17 when I saw that movie. And I just really enjoyed the surreal aspect of the storytelling and the fact that I enjoyed Kevin Spacey as an actor. Because it was just the kind of movie that I had never seen before. You know, I had never really seen a self-serious movie before. And so I, being a self-serious 17-year-old, I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And
yeah, I guess it was just that sense of pretend. It borders into pretentiousness, you know.
Yeah. I think he comes about as close as you can as a director before he crosses that line, but I think his proximity to it makes enough people kind of roll their eyes that, yes, he can't be ignored because he is making quality films, but, you know, I think it's, I think, yeah, yes, Sam, it's very impressive, like, you know.
For certain things, that's okay. This is a serious subject matter, and he's treating it in a serious way, so that's okay. You know, he's not doing MASH. Fine.
Right.
You know, these other movies, you know, American, like Skyfall, did Skyfall have to have that self-serious sense to it? I thought it just bogged the whole thing down. And I'm not saying it has to be any of the Roger Moore ones, but I think it swung too far in the other direction. I think that's what made such, you know, Spectre such a bore, you know, on top of having a ridiculous plot. It was shot like it was a, you know, not very fun. So if you're going to have a ridiculous concept but not have any fun watching it, it's really a slog.
I guess. I mean, we'll get into that another time, maybe. But like, that's the point we'll take. And like, you know, to take a lighthearted idea like a spy movie and then make it so serious as to be almost morose at times. It seems sort of counterintuitive.
And like I get what he was doing with American Beauty, in that the suburbs and this sort of life when you delude yourself can be soul crushing. So okay, I get that. It just, I wouldn't want to watch that. I'd rather watch the war movie.
Yeah, you know? I think his style and his sensibility lends itself very very much to this kind of storytelling than the more banal or the, you know, the previously more lighthearted. I have heard lots of talk about Roger Deakins and his relationship to Sam Mendes and the Coen brothers. He was the director of photography for this movie. And so I had heard that he's, you know, I forget how his name came up first, but they were saying that, like, you know, if you like Skyfall, chances are you like Skyfall because of this guy, not necessarily because of Roger Deakins. Like, the way that Skyfall looked, it was like, you know, Skyfall had a look that Spectre did not, and I missed it in Spectre. Like, I liked seeing it in Skyfall. And, you know, like, my, you know, one of the, I think it's a great scene, is the scene where Bond goes and chases down that assassin guy in Hong Kong or some city in Asia, and he you know, follows him up to the empty office buildings across the street from a Target, and he's ends up getting into a fist fight with him. And in the backdrop is all the giant neon signs or LED signs that are shining off the glass, and so you can kind of, you can't see who's fighting who once the fight starts, and so you can't see who's winning until the very end, and it just looks gorgeous and is fun because you're like, well, who's the one hanging from the building? Is it Bond or the other guy? And it could be either one, because Bond gets out of scrapes all the time, and so it turns out that he's, you know, this guy Roger Deakins has, you know, been the cinematographer for pretty much every movie that we've liked in a long time, or at least every film that's been, you know, sort of seriously considered, you know, from like the Big Lebowski, The Siege, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Like, not necessarily my favorite movies, but I can tell that there's a visual quality to them. You know, No Country for Old Men. That, you know, so the way they look is very, very interesting. These things are just they're lit well, they're shot well, and I thought that the scene in 1917, when this guy wakes up and that church is on fire, is just about one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen on film. And I saw this in like a little theater in, you know, in the town I live in. I didn't go see it in Dolby. I didn't go see it in IMAX. I kind of wish I had. I'm going to try to like make a point, if I can, to go see some of the upcoming films that are like, that I know are sort of visual events in that format, because it's, you know, it's helpful. But like, I really wish I had seen that, you know, when they're shooting those magnesium flares and he's running through the town, and he, you know, then he's, church is on fire and he's in and out of shadow, and it was just brilliant. It was just breathtaking. So
here's the thing with that. I didn't like that one scene where he's with the woman.
Okay.
When the second guy dies and the first guy's alone, and he goes and, you know, he hitches a ride, and then they say, we can't cross with the cars. And he goes, well, I'll just go on foot. And he gets hit by a sniper, kills the sniper at the same time. And then he wakes up in some random town. Like, I don't know where that is. And okay, I get it. It's some sort of bombed out area, but there are Germans everywhere. So like, you lose your real sense of place when he loses his map buddy, because he has no one to talk to. So he never says, I don't know where I am, and I don't know which direction I am going in. And like, the French woman that he runs across with the baby tells him the river that way, that way. And eventually he stumbles into it by mistake. But beyond that, there was that sense of like killing time, because there's no one for him to interact with, and he's not going to just start blabbing out loud, or he might get shot by somebody. So there was a lot of like, where is this going exactly? And you're right, it looked great. Like, because people were coming out of the darkness, and when they would spot him, they would shoot him immediately. And he would just run, because he wasn't sure who was who in the dark, you know. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't know where we are, and I don't know where he's supposed to be going, because no one's saying anything, you know. What is the point of all of this?
Well, the point of all that was he didn't know where to go, and she told him. Like, you're right. He had lost his buddy, who was the main resource. So he just before his friend dies, they find the cow with the milk, and he. So that scene does two things. One is he begins to shed all of his belongings. He's starting to realize that, like, I'm probably not going to get back from this. So he sees them with the baby. It's gut-wrenching, Christ's sakes, when she says that she doesn't know whose baby it is. I mean, I almost bawled right there. That's just unbelievably sad. He says, I have all this food. And she's like, he can't eat that. He needs milk. And he happened to have milk, and kind of connected that bit. And then you see him just start to, you know, you learn about him because he can talk to a baby. And, you know, the baby's calm around him. He's a father. You don't know that till the end, but you're learning a bit about him. He sheds everything he doesn't need. He gives her all of his food, all the milk. He's got nothing but his gun now. And then she gives him a crucial piece of information, is you have to travel this way to the river, and the river goes by Akust, or goes, will take you to this place. So the scene gives you information about him, although it's very, very subtle. It gives you information about, you know, the devastation this is happening on people who are surviving and how they're hiding out. You get a sense of the scope of, you know, who's involved with the conflict, and you get and he gets information as to how to continue. But there is no break for humor. There is no moment to laugh, to give the audience a pause. This is sort of all that they're going to give you, and it's frustrating, but that's what they're, that's the function that the scene serves.
No, I know. It's just that he almost gets shot in that scene like a bunch of times. And he stumbles into the river by mistake.
Does he though? I think he's heading in that direction. Yes, he's running from the bad guys, but I guess he finds it by accident, but he was going to, you know, it's basically when he walks out of that, you know, building, he has to turn left or right, and he turns towards the river and then runs towards it, fleeing the guys at that point, kind of hodgepodge and higgledy-piggledy.
Because people are shooting it, so it's dark is the whole idea. He goes in the direction that he didn't come from, and then he starts zigzagging so he doesn't get shot. And then he tumbles and falls into it and then gets swept down. And that's the whole thing. Like, he's about to give up. The flower petals hit him. He realizes, I can't give up. I wake up. I get to the end of the river where all these dead bodies have gathered, which is gross.
Yeah.
And he just runs into a company, and it happens to be the company he's looking for. So, like, there's just this long pause where you realize, you're right, okay, he can talk to children, he's a nice guy, which we already knew, but, you know.
Not so much that he's giving her the stuff, it's that he's keeping none of it for himself. It's not so much that he's like, here, I'm a nice guy, have my food. It's like, I'm probably not going to make it, so better that you have all this tinned food than it die, you know, than it lay with me, when it, you know, and then the Germans get it. So it's his sense of sort of like not closing the door behind him and saying, I'm probably not making it out of here. I'm not going to have use for this when I'm dead. So you take it. That's kind of how I read it. I didn't see it that way.
Like, which is not to say that you're right or wrong. It's just that he gives her all the food as in, like, you know, I'm just so nice, you take this, because if I happen to get where I'm going, I won't need it. If I should die, well, I definitely won't need it. And he loses all of his other gear in other ways. Like, he loses the gun in the river and his pack while he's running and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the idea, that by the time he finally gets there, he's stripped to the bone. I mean, and I noticed that in the very beginning of the movie. I'm like, man, they have a lot of stuff. You know, and soldiers do. They have a lot of stuff. You know, he loses the helmet when he gets shot because it's dented, and yeah. You know, it was fine. It was just, it felt like the movie had to take a pause and find some way to get him going again, because he lost the only thing he was playing off of.
Yeah,
which was just the choice they made. That's all.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie "They Shall Not Grow Old"?
No. So I heard a lot of good things.
Yeah, I started watching it. Recently, for those unaware, this is the Peter Jackson World War One documentary that he made. And, you know, like all good modern documentaries, it involves no interviews with, like, important scholars. It's just all primary source material. It's, you know, they combed through about 600 hours of interviews with British veterans from the Great War, and put it together with some old footage that they left some of it as is, and they colorized some of it and made it look sort of modern, and they added in some voiceovers and some sound effects to give you a... But it was a very, like, you know, you are there kind of soldier's perspective on it. And it's about a third of the way through, and it's really interesting because it's, you know, it's just well done, and the subject matter is intense. But, yeah, no, it's... They talked about the pack. It was 90 pounds they had to carry around with them, which for some of them was like, you know, half their own body weight. You know, these guys are young.
Yeah.
And the thing that always strikes me about, you know, primary source war information, World War One and World War Two, and even the Civil War, is just sort of how eager everybody is to go to war. And they were all thought this would be great fun. You know, we'll go, we'll have a laugh. It'll be like going to camp, and it'll be exciting and dangerous. And, you know, people as young as like 15, 16 were going, and like nobody had any scruples. There were stories about guys who would go in to the recruiting office and say, I want to join up. And they go, well, how old are you? He'd be like, well, I'm 16. Like, all right, cool. Go outside, have a birthday, and then come back in here, and then tell me how old you are again. Like, all these kind of really, you know, crazy stories. And of course, they get there, and it's horrible. And then, you know, it's where the term shell shocked comes from. You know, things don't go well, and you know, but World War II, you get the same stories. You know, like everyone was eager to go, and they get there, and oh, it's terrible. And you know, I don't think anybody feels that way. I think we know too much now about how this goes. You know, and that's why movies get made like this, where like nobody has any illusions about what they're doing. It's just, it's awful from beginning to end. And
well, yeah, we got pictures now.
Well, we had pictures then too, and you know, there's plenty of people. I mean, General Sherman from the Civil War was always quoted as saying, you know, war is all hell, and you know, nobody who knew anything had any illusions then. But we tend to forget it after a while. You know, that's why, like, I've always enjoyed Starship Troopers, because that, you know, is one of the almost comical aspects of that movie, is everyone signs up to join the space marines or whatever they are to go fight the bugs. And, you know,
movie's so ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous. But like, they're like, yeah, we're going to go and kill the, and then the first scene of the movie, it's just this horrifying massacre, you know, it's bloodbath.
It's bloodbath,
you know, and like the
people get chopped in half and stuff.
Oh yeah, the reporter, wasn't there like a,
yeah,
like
a,
he dies guy. Like in the first 2 seconds, like,
yeah.
And it's comical, but like that has a basis in something. It's not entirely out of nowhere that they, you know, that they should, because people did really believe that, and then they get there and they go, oh, this is what we're doing. Oh, you know, some of the stories are just. It's just about how they lived, you know, which is why I really enjoyed. So when they, like, in the scene where they get to that first German trench and they climb in the bunker, just the difference between the British bunker, the British trench and the German trench, like how, like, everything was neat and everything's at right angles, and there's cement, and they have beds, and they're like, they have bunk beds and the whole thing. And one of them even says, my God, they built all this. Look at this. And they get out to where they were doing the shelling, and they built like a cavern, you know, or not like a cavern, but like a trench, this giant, huge pit that they had been firing all their guns from. And, you know, they see all these giant shells left over. And that's a great scene, I thought, cause it was such a great contrast. But
yeah, well, it's not the way war is done now. And when you look at it, the concept is so insane, but you know, there's nothing that compares. So,
yeah. So
anyway, but it was good. It was a good movie.
I thought it was great. It's really worth seeing, I think.
So. I'm not mad it's nominated for Best Picture. like, yeah, this was definitely one of the best movies I've seen this year.
Yeah. Trying to remember now which were. So it was this. It was Ford v. Ferrari. It was
Joker.
Joker, yeah.
Parasite. Little Women. I just looked it up today.
Marriage Story.
Gloria, no. The Irishman.
Yeah, Jojo Rabbit, The Irishman. It was nine, Jojo right? Rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's odd they don't always nominate 10 movies, although they can.
Yeah, I don't quite get that, because that was like a whole thing.
Yeah.
Where they wanted to, like, oh, well, you know, we snubbed this movie that everyone loved.
The Dark Knight.
Dark Knight, yeah. And, yeah. What do you think's going to win this one?
I'd say either this, maybe, you know, and maybe Marriage Story, maybe Parasite.
It's not going to be Marriage Story or The Irishman.
No, not The Irishman.
I think just for political purposes, anything. They're not going to give the award to a film produced by Netflix. They're just. That seems very stupid to do that.
I mean, is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood not like a realistic idea?
I think that'll win.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, this or 19 that or 1917. But again, yeah, it's like, to me, I always look at these in terms of the politics. They're not going to give it to Joker because, you know, there was politics about, you know, the justification of violence, which was dumb. It was a stupid controversy for that movie, but like, it happened. They're not going to give it to Ford v. Ferrari because it was a boys' movie about cars. They're not going to give it to Jojo Rabbit because it's, yeah, it's the right take on Hitler and everything, but it's a little too small a film, I think, as was Little Women. And then I don't know anything about Parasite beyond the fact that it's about like a lower class family that begins to sort of take over the lives of an upper class family.
Yeah, they like start moving in and it's a whole class-based thing.
Yeah, that might win, but again, I don't see them giving it to a South Korean. That seems odd, which pretty much leaves Tarantino in this. And I think, I don't know, like, they like movies about themselves.
Well, there really aren't very many of those this time. Just the Tarantino movie, and that's about it.
Yeah, so like,
yeah.
You know, and I can't think of the last time that, I think, yeah, La La Land.
Oh, yeah, La La Land.
People were convinced that La La Land was going to win because it was a love letter to Hollywood. And
it didn't, though, right?
No. Was that the year of the big screw-up?
No, that was the Moonlight.
Right. So what did they think? What did they announce? Was it La La Land? It's just,
they announced, I don't remember. I can't get the list up fast enough, so.
I don't know, like you're trying to talk, I'm trying to,
you know. That was 2017. So that was the year that it was nominated. Let's see. Best
pick. Yeah, no, it was La La Land that they had called incorrectly as the winner. So I was, you know, everyone that I listened to in podcasts and read said this is likely to win because it's about us and we love us. And
there's somebody screaming into his microphone right now. It was La La Land. Yes. Okay. I'm sorry, everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. But
right.
So yeah, so I mean, my money would be on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with a, you know, with a runner up bet placed on 1917. But we'll see. You know, they like, you know, whenever there's complaints about war movies, it's always like, well, there weren't any women in that movie. Like, well, yes. You know, like that's what they said about Dunkirk. You know, was
well, yeah.
No gals in the picture, huh? No.
No, sorry.
A third of it takes place in the cockpit of a Spitfire, so
that's crowded in there.
I don't know how you'd get her in there, but hats off to you if you do.
Yeah, they do that every year. I think people just tune it out now.
You know what? That's not true. I wish that were true, but nobody tunes that out.
But I mean,
not
like,
enough people tune it out.
I mean, if you ignore it on Twitter, it's easy to ignore. It doesn't come up as much.
Well, yeah. Sure.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm not seeing as much. There wasn't a film by a woman on the list this year. Usually that comes up all the time.
Well, like that's why I was surprised when Little Women made the cut. Because, again, I haven't seen it. I heard it's doing well financially. Like, it's, you know, it's a movie targeted at, like, an older female audience. And it's done well there. They've made money. Mm-hmm. No one has said, like, oh, this is, you know, like a best picture contender. No one's brought that up. So when I saw it there, I was like, huh, we're just filling a quota here? Like, which is, I don't like to say that. I'm sure we'll get letters now. But it's possible that's why that's there. You know,
mm-hmm.
I hope not.
I hope for a lot of things.
That's true. All right. Anything else?
No.
You need to hit?
I don't think so. It was a good time.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I liked it. You liked it too. Go see 1917. All right. But
don't eat lunch beforehand.
Blah. Yeah, some of it's a little bit much, you know. No big Mexican meals really. All right. So yeah, before we go though, I want to remind you that we are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen. Subscribe, tell friends, leave a review. Twitter and Instagram is at @ThreeDrinksInPod. There's the Facebook page, and you can email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. All right, as always, please drink responsibly.
Take care.
We'll talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye.